Hello, everybody, and welcome to this Q&A with APARC visiting scholar, Professor James Millward. Professor Millward is a scholar of the Qing Empire, the Silk Road, Eurasian lutes and music and history, and the historical and contemporary Xinjiang. He's published a number of books on the topic, including The Silk Road, A Very Short Introduction, New Qing Imperial History, The Making of Inner Asian Empire at Qing Chengde, as well as his most recent publication, Eurasian Crossroads, A History of Xinjiang. He has published important commentary on contemporary Xinjiang and Chinese politics more generally in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Guardian, among others. Professor Millward joins both the Walter H. Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center's China program, as well as the Stanford History Department as a visiting scholar for winter 2022. Millward is currently a professor of intersocietal history at the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. And he actually received his PhD from Stanford History, studying with the late Professor Harold Kahn. On February 2nd of this year, Professor Millward joined us for a public program entitled The Crisis in Xinjiang, What's Happening Now and What Does It Mean? As many of you know, the situation in China's Xinjiang province has become increasingly concerning, and we have heard reports of mass detention, forced labor, destruction of mosques, and more. In his talk, Professor Millward discussed the historical context for current events in Xinjiang, as well as how we should understand them in the broader context of contemporary Chinese politics under Xi Jinping. You can view a recording of that talk now on our YouTube channel, Shorenstein APARC. Professor Millward, it's great to speak with you today.
Thank you very much, Calista. I'm pleased to be with you over Zoom, yes. At least.
So I'll start out with a bit of a more general question and ask, what has shaped your interest in and research on the Qing dynasty, PRC ethnic policy, and Xinjiang?
Well, that's a big question. I started out, I guess, to being interested in China, and then migrated to the frontiers, in particular Xinjiang, you know, early on when I was doing my PhD, and there were very few people working on non-Han parts of China or the Qing in those days, and I was actually sort of discouraged, not by my advisors or anything, but just by the fact that everything I was reading was about, you know, other parts of China, or what was seen to be, you know, central China or Han China. And that was actually a common experience for other people, particularly anthropologists in the, you know, 80s and 90s, who were just beginning to work on non-Han parts of China as well, and peoples. And I think it kind of tracks a shift that happened maybe a little bit earlier in American studies, with a greater interest in, you know, what today we call diversity or multiculturalism, and those aspects of these societies. And so maybe, you know, that was part of it, but there was a similar phenomenon going on in China as well, among Chinese scholars who were beginning to study the frontiers or borderland studies there. And this was particularly important with regard to the Qing Empire, because the Qing is in fact when the boundaries of what are now the People's Republic of China, that's when that empire was formed. And the PRC Chinese nationalists early in the 20th century, but followed up by the PRC, had decided that the territory of the former Qing Empire was the territory that they wanted to make into new China. So as things have developed, and as both, you know, in the contemporary world, but also in the field of China studies, these so-called peripheral areas and non-Han peoples have become, you know, much more important, and really central, I think, to our trying to understand of what China is today and who the Chinese are.
So you recently released a revised and updated version of your book, Eurasian Crossroads, A History of Xinjiang. Originally, it was published in 2006. So I'm curious, what is new about this version of the book, and why did you feel like it was important to publish an updated version now?
So when I finished writing, the book came out in the early 2000s. There's always a time lag, right? So it came up to the early, you know, the first years of the new millennium. But there have been many events, you know, since then, and I talked about these in the longer lecture that you referred people to before. Obviously, what's happened the last 4 or 5 years in Xinjiang is of great global importance and interest to people, And although it's a little bit early to write the history of this period of repression, I think it was important at least to try and get an organized draft of it down and to try to begin to interpret rather than just narrate, you know, the sort of litany of things going on, that, you know, the camps and the digital surveillance and forced labor and birth suppressions and all of those, and try and put it into some kind of framework whereby, you know, we can understand it. And the framework that I chose is to talk about really a reversal of what had been an earlier approach to diversity in China, that of the 56 different Minzu or nationalities and that of regional autonomous regions, and to point out a really aggressive, what I see as a very aggressive assimilating thrust under the Xi Jinping regime. And then also to look more clearly at settler colonialism in Xinjiang, and to start to, and I use that as a title of, in the title of the new chapter in the book. And I think, you know, we haven't really talked about that too much, and maybe we've shied away from using that terminology, but I think, and I'm not alone in this, that there's scholars in the field are beginning to talk about it more. And, you know, just as we should absolutely talk about settler colonialism in the United States, and the, you know, the expanse of European peoples and people of European ancestry across the continent, then we really should look at analogous processes and abuses really in China as well.
So to transition a little bit more to current events, as you mentioned, we've seen a lot of, you know, really quite disturbing developments coming out of Xinjiang. And I'm curious, how do we know what we know about current events in Xinjiang?
Well, that's a big question, and you know, we could talk a long time about it, but we know from a wide variety of different sources, of independent sources, and a wide variety of different kinds of materials. These include independent researchers, they include media organizations all over the world, they include some information from nation states, although actually, for the most part, it's been researchers and journalists and others who've been sort of gathering this and nation states responding. They include documents that have been leaked, probably at great personal risk, by people in Xinjiang and people in China, party documents and others. They include satellite imagery, which of course now, you know, we can get in not real time, but we can also get, you know, you can compare previous images over a period of years with contemporary images. And that allows you to get a real good sense of how things have changed, either the building of concentration camps or the destruction of mosques and cemeteries and that kind of thing, all of which has been, you know, documented. And then a lot of first-person testimony from Kazakhs and Uyghurs who have been in the camps or have either as prisoners or as so-called teachers, from their relatives and others who've heard from people there. So it's by no means, as some people claim, you know, one study by one researcher or a claim by, you know, the United States government or something like that. It's a panoply of sources, and it's really, you know, it's quite amazing how much information we have and how much of it actually comes from open source government websites and documents, county level throughout Xinjiang.
So speaking of the United States government, how do you see Xinjiang fitting into the current relationship between the US and China, and how important is it to that relationship?
Well, it's very important. The Trump administration ended up in a very strong anti-China, you know, kind of China bashing sort of approach. Many of those policies were, you know, unjustified. I mean, Trump unilaterally launched a trade war, and things like that. The China Initiative, which was launched by his Justice Department, you know, for the first time ever, that kind of a program singled out one nationality for concern about so-called espionage in business and in universities and so on. And that has thankfully now been, at least the name has been removed. But the Trump administration corresponded with the emergence of information about what was going on in China. And they also began to implement some policies and some sanctions about that. And certainly that the nature of what has been happening in Xinjiang in a rather remarkable way appealed to all political, both sides of the aisle in American political discourse. With slightly different flavors, and sort of on the right wing, they kind of play up the religious side more. Maybe on the left, it's more about human rights, those kind of terminology, but more or less corresponding. So I think that, along with other concerns and strategic concerns and so on, but probably more than anything else, the Xinjiang issue has contributed to the broad spectrum feeling in the American political sphere that engagement failed, which is actually not something that I believe in. I think it depends what you mean by engagement and what you expected, and some of the expectations were unreasonable and so on. I'm not a decoupler, but I think the parallels to some of the worst events of the 20th century in Europe, the use of concentration camps, and some of the Orwellian aspects of what's going on there, in an odd way, it's brought together the political sides in America. They rallied them around a much stronger anti-China stance.
Mm-hmm. So, considering the priorities and the leadership styles of the two countries right now, do you think it's possible for the U.S. to both act on Xinjiang while also cooperating with China on other issues?
I mean, it's not only possible, it's just necessary, right? And this is the art of diplomacy. You have to compartmentalize, you have to deal with different issues, and particularly with two countries as large as the United States and China, we have a huge range of different things to talk about. And it's not simply even just, oh my gosh, climate or human right. Those kind of simplistic dichotomies are, you can't get anywhere with them. We have 300,000 Chinese students in our own universities here. And we welcome them and learn a lot from them. And we benefit from Chinese expertise in all sorts of ways. We benefit at the, somewhat less so now with trade interruptions and supply chain problems, but the cost of solar panels and of solar energy generally has gone down because of the Chinese production of these sorts of materials for a broader Chinese market. That's just one example. So I think the approach to the Xinjiang issue will be most effective will be to try to explain how it is actually hurtful for China to be doing that. And yes, to a certain extent, some of that hurt is coming from US sanctions, but not only from US sanctions, it's coming from businesses running away from having their brands tainted by the idea of Xinjiang cotton, for example, with forced labor. I think and reminding China that this is actually a reversal of their own previous kind of approaches to diversity issues. Those kind of tactics, I think, will be better than the finger waving. I think that the word genocide is not, one can debate one way or another. I don't think it's entirely inappropriate. I think what we're looking at are, certainly genocidal kinds of things. But at the same time, you have to explain, you have to provide the evidence, and also you have to explain, why these things are not in China's interest. and admit and do so from a position that recognizes, you know, and in fact that uses the American past and American problems with diversity as part of our reason for explaining why, when we, you know, on a higher ground of human values, why these things matter. It's not just we're trying to impose American values. These are human values shared by Chinese that are being violated by these policies.
So to pivot back to you for a little bit, as I mentioned earlier, you received your PhD in history here at Stanford. How does it feel to return to the university, back to the farm?
Oh, well, it's great. I love it out here. It's been almost 40 years since I was, you know, here. As people may or may not know, the way PhDs work, you know, you have a few years on campus and then you're kind of off doing other things. In my case, I was here from around, I guess, 86 through 89 or, yeah, 85 through 88, and then away for a couple of years, and then back in 92 for a semester. So needless to say, a lot has changed, particularly out on the kind of engineering computer science part of the campus. So I've enjoyed riding my bike around there and just seeing all of that construction. Unfortunately, I guess the trailer park where I lived as a first year graduate student is no more, and I couldn't even find like the footprint of where it was. But Escondido Village, where I lived, is still there. So you know, some of those things are, there's still a few anchors for my aging memory. But I don't think a lot of campuses in the United States have changed as much as Stanford has in this period of time. And that way it's kind of more like a Chinese campus, which have, you know, exploded with new buildings coming up like mushrooms after the rain. And it's, you know, interesting, but it's great to be here.
So what are you working on while here at APARC, and how has your time here aided your research?
Well, it's aided my research by having, you know, good facilities and nice weather, I suppose. And the thing about nice weather is, nice weather means you don't actually have to go out and enjoy it on any one day, because you know you can always go out and enjoy it the next day. You can count on it being nice on the weekends. And this is something that, you know, in the East we don't have. But I'm working on actually two projects that are kind of related in my head but have different audiences. And one is on decolonizing historiography of China, the way we talk about it. And that's a project that I've been working on for a couple of years, and sort of turned, I thought it would be an article, it's kind of turned into a little book. I spent a few weeks here kind of working on that, and we'll be workshopping it at the history department in a couple of weeks. And that's just looking at our terminology and concepts and trying to understand some of the ways in which our usual kind of paradigms and just accepted things such as talking about the tribute system or even the idea of, you know, dynasties themselves presents this ahistorical sense of political continuity. I'm not talking about cultural continuity, but political continuity that's not really true. And then the other project, which is what I was, in the proposal for this fellowship, what I wrote, is a comparison of the United States and of the People's Republic of China, and a little bit earlier in that, so modern China, I suppose, and modern US, in terms of diversity, in terms of colonialism, in terms of empire, in terms of our attitudes towards ethnic difference and race. And it's a comparison, but I think the main thrust is going to be that the US and China are actually more alike than we usually think. And alike in some bad ways and alike in some good ways around these issues of diversity. But I'm writing that for a general audience and trying to kind of, you know, open, and I'm thinking as I'm writing of a Chinese audience as well as of an English reading audience. And my idea at least is to publish this almost simultaneously in both Chinese and in English. It's kind of a conversation, you know, among Americans and Chinese and anyone else who cares to read it, to kind of consider our own past and consider our own presence and future with regard to diversity, human diversity, but also diversity in the environment, looking forward to the great challenges that we have to arrest and maybe reverse climate change.
Those sound like some incredibly interesting and important topics. Do you happen to be collaborating with anybody here at FSI or perhaps in the history department on those projects or others?
Well, as I mentioned, history department has very kindly offered to do a workshop on this. So Professor Matt Summer and Professor Tom Mullaney, who I've known for many years, are helping with that. And Professor Karen Wiggin as well. I just had a great conversation with them. And of course, here at APARC, Gene Oy and Andrew Walder very kindly took me out to lunch and we had good discussions. And so it's actually, it's been a little interesting coming, under the sort of what we hope is the tail end of COVID conditions. But nonetheless, everyone has been very welcoming and reached out. I've had many opportunities for very constructive conversations.
So talking a little bit more about perhaps more current events, has the global pandemic affected your ability to travel and do research at all? And how have you adapted?
Well, for what I'm currently working on, it's actually probably been good because it's slowed me down a bit. And particularly with all of the concern about what's been going on in Xinjiang for a couple of years before March of 2020, I was traveling a lot and giving a lot of talks. And so now we all know how to give those talks, as I did here, without going somewhere. And that, of course, has downsides, but one of the good sides is it takes a little bit less time. But again, for what I'm working on now, I need a library nearby, but I don't really need to travel too much. And so I'm one of the fortunate people for whom being somewhat locked down has not been a disaster.
So we are, of course, winding down towards the end of winter quarter here. So I wanted to ask what is on the horizon for you and what's next?
Hawaii is on the horizon. The Association of Asian Studies meetings are there. And so I will be going towards the end of March out there. And it's meeting in a weird kind of, it's not a hybrid way. There's both online and then also in-person meetings, which is good. We're all looking forward to that. So yeah, there'll be a roundtable there on decolonizing Chinese historiography, the very thing I'm working on, which I'm looking forward to, and also talking to potential authors. I edit a book series for University of Chicago Press called Silk Roads. And so I'll be talking to potential authors for that series and others about kind of what books haven't been written yet that should be written that are transnational and interdisciplinary and that would fit into a very broad kind of metaphorical Silk Roads framework for that series. And then after Honolulu, I go to Oslo. So my carbon footprint is not good. It's not good right now.
Well, I think you're doing incredibly important research. So hopefully it's all for the best. Well, Professor Millward, thank you so much for sitting down and talking with me today. It's been incredibly enlightening. And I hope that you enjoy the rest of your time here at APARC and at Stanford.
Well, thank you very much. And thanks for making me so welcome and giving me this wonderful opportunity to come back to Stanford and also just have time to work and think.